This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 346. Just don't know when to quit. Not coming in tomorrow, I don't think. Got to go do grocery shopping for Mom and Dad, and then our own grocery shopping, and then I've got a doctor's appointment to take my dad to for the general anesthesiologist chat. He's having quasi-outpatient surgery on Monday. They're not sure whether he's going to spend the night or not spend the night. The doctor has to make that determination afterwards. He's having prostate surgery, but it is, there's no major incisions. So it'll, you know, we think it'll be fine. He said this, they are to the point now where he said this surgery should be no more dangerous for a 92-year-old than it is for a 72-year-old. So, and Dad's strong, so we're not really expecting any problems. And it might, you know, resolve an issue with him having difficulty urinating. And so that will be good, you know, to take care of that problem, even though he is 92 and 3/4, soon to be 92 and 10 months, 2 months away from being 93. So it's fun. We're just keeping moving forward. Then if this goes well and he gets all recuperated from this, then maybe in 3 or 4 months or so, we'll look at doing the gallbladder surgery. But we wanted to get through this one first and just pray that his gallbladder stays settled down and stays happy until we can get through this, get him healed up, get him ready to go to the next phase. So it'll be interesting. Tomorrow the appointment is like at 10:30, which is fine. Monday, the surgery on the 16th of November, it's going to be at 5:30. I have to have him to the hospital at 5:30 in the morning. So that'll be a little bit of a challenge, but I'll go to bed early, you know, wake up around 4:30, 4 o'clock or so, and get in the car and call him and say, "Get up, Dad!" Although I know my dad well enough to know he is not going to sleep Sunday night, Monday morning. He's just not going to. He's going to be wiped out because he will have been up all night. My dad comes from kind of a long line of worriers. And that was one thing that he held on to in his life, despite all the amazing, astounding things that he has seen in his life and that God has accomplished through him. It's really some amazing stuff. But, you know, get off. Hold on to that worry. So that's okay. We all have our own ways of approaching life. Thankfully, I not only had a father, but I had a mother who took a different approach to life. Took a very optimistic, clear-eyed, gung-ho approach. And I really do cherish fact that I had two very different and yet ultimately very complementary parents, and that I took advantage of that at a very early age to recognize that they each had strengths, they each had weaknesses, and what I tried to do was to invest in the strengths that they had placed in me from their experience and to offer grace to the weaknesses. So it's good, it's good, it's good. This has kind of been a little bit of a lazy week, frankly, for me when it comes to writing. Got off to a roaring start on Sunday. Didn't quite make my 3,000 words, but I made my 2,500. And I didn't push as hard as I could have because this is the last week before I start editing up The Straight Gate, which is book 3 in the Windfall series. And I knew I was far enough along that I was nearly halfway through the book, and I only had a couple of more thousand words to go to be halfway through the book. Well, by the end of Sunday night, I was basically halfway through the book. I think I was on page 206 or 207, and these books usually, they were supposed to be running somewhere around 100,000 words, and they have kind of floated up to where they're running about 125, 140. So I had gotten up to 64, so 64, 65 by the end of Sunday. Well, you know, that's 130. I'm halfway at that point. Monday night, I did a video chat with my godson. Always enjoy those. And so that kind of was happening in the middle of the evening. So I did get some editing done, but I put down very few words Monday. And then Tuesday, I got home, and lo and behold, the grandkids were there. Yay! Mom and Dad were out on a date. Our kids were out on a date, and the grandkids were there. So I went downstairs and did some exercising. By that point, Mom and Dad were back. And so I went upstairs, and we all sat around and talked for hour, hour and a half. And by that time, the evening was pretty well gone. So, you know, that's fine. Because, you know, it's fine. And then last night, I had a bunch of stuff that I had to take care of. And so I got that all taken care of and managed to put down, I don't know, 300 or 400 words, something like that. And then it was time to go to bed. So, but still, you know, I'll probably get another, I don't know, 300 or 400 words down tonight. And then tomorrow, I'll probably be able to get several hours in. Although, I'm harvesting sauerkraut tomorrow. Yay! Always like harvesting sauerkraut. And so, you know, if I get another 500 or 600 done on Friday, I should have a good block of time on Saturday. And in that block of time, should be able to put down 1,500 words or so. And so I will be closing in. I should be close. Don't think I'll get there, but I should be close to about 70,000 words, which is absolutely halfway. The book really should not go over 140,000 words. So I think we're good. We're good. It's going to be fine. A little bit of a lazy week, but it's kind of a nice little break. You know, start in, do some editing, and then jump back in come January 1st. Finish up the next book, which is A Seed in Secret. And that seems to be going fine. So it's the passage. One of the reasons I didn't get much written last night is because I was coming back to one of the minor characters and I just didn't have it. I didn't have what the point of it all was. I didn't, you know, and it just was not emotionally engaging. And so sometimes I just have to get started. You just have to write, and then you realize, oh, wrong direction. Then you back up and move in. So finally, I just started writing, and I put down several hundred words, but at the time I knew, yeah, this is not it. So kind of mulled it over, and I think when I was driving in today was when it finally kind of, I went, oh, yeah, that's what I should do. Because sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge to imagine what these people are going through, because it's coming from such a different mindset. It's coming from, I mean, you talk about entitlement and a feeling of entitlement. I mean, it's coming from an extremely entitled and yet at the same time should be gracious and kind attitude. And so the key for this one was I was trying to make him a little too hard-nosed about it, when really it shouldn't be hard-nosed. It should be he's encountering things that he has intentionally ignored the circumstances of those who are far less well-off than he is. And so I really needed to play off that tension. And it's something that I easily relate to because I grew up in the Philippines, and we were doing these trips back and forth with, you know, 4 or 5 years on, 1 year, 1 or 2 years back, 4 or 5 years on. And so you come back to the States and there's 150 different types of cereal on the cereal aisle, and you go back to the Philippines and people are living in three pieces of tin that are leaned up against each other. I mean, it's just jarring. And we would see that jarring every time someone would come out to work with us short term. Kind of standard way we would bring them home from the airport was we would take them through Makati, which was one of the business housing areas where there would be houses that were an entire city block surrounded by these high fences, and the houses vault up over these high cement fences. Just money, lots of money. And then we'd go from that down and down through some of the poorest barrios, and people would just be, the inequity would just stun them. And that thing is what I need to capitalize on in this particular scene. Because it would happen. It would happen in these circumstances. So once I got that, now, you know, I can groove on that thing because I've lived that. So that'll be fine. I just drove by a car. I had a truck with a camper out of the back. So it had on the sign, rare find, because they're selling it. Rare find, clean. Okay. So the book writing's going fine. Had some nice compliments coming back from some of the beta readers. Still haven't heard back from some of my mainline beta readers, but some of them wait until the last moment and they come rushing in, so I'm expecting they're going to come rushing in over the next few days. And they all know that even though I say November 15th that I'm going to write them and say, okay, look, that's okay if you don't have it in yet. I've got other input to work through. That's going to take me a week, 2 weeks. So if you're not quite done, just finish it up and send it to me when you get done. So we'll get it in. We'll get it in. And we'll go from there. It's really going to be interesting to see. Once we get into book 10, book 11, book 12. It's just really going to be interesting to see how many beta readers I actually have. Yeah. Anyways. Today, really kind of review. I've talked about this in the past, and I think I've talked about some of this study, but there's some extra information in this that I thought, oh, well, that's pretty interesting. And it's really kind of fascinating to me to watch how people dance around the issue and scratch their heads, where if they would just think about the core a little bit and embrace the core of the motivations, things become understandable. And I mean, they've got the pieces, but it's like you just never get down to the core. So it's interesting. I think the article was called, and sorry for the language, but The Evolution of Bitchiness. And no surprise here, they note that women engage in indirect aggression and slut-shaming, even in clinical research studies. Why? That's the question. Why? So this article is trying to answer the why, and they say, well, it could be this, could be that, could be this. Well, this could be driving it. But they never really get down to the core issue, at least in my opinion. But there's some interesting stuff that they bring up in addition to a previous study that I had talked about months ago at this point. So I thought, here we go. Anyways, so one day in Ontario, and this is some time ago because I read about this study months ago. One day in Ontario, 86 straight women were paired off into groups of two, either with a friend or a stranger, and taken to a lab at McMaster University. Okay. There, a researcher told them they were about to partake in a study about female friendships, but they were soon interrupted by one of two women. Half the participants were interrupted by a thin, blonde, attractive woman with her hair in a bun, dressed in a plain blue t-shirt, khaki pants, whom the researchers called the conservative Confederate. The other half found themselves in the company of the sexy Confederate. The same woman, instead wearing a low-cut blouse, a short black skirt, boots, and with her hair sexily unbunned. Okay. So, you know, female power, women need women solidarity, all that stuff. So Tracy Valancourt, a psychology professor at the University of Ottawa and a PhD student, Anachal Sharma, they gauged the women's reactions as the Confederates, both sexy and not, left the room. A metric they used, a bitchiness scale, of course. And so the author of the article said, why do you call it bitchiness? And they said, look, bitchiness is a term that people use. When I ask people to describe this behavior, they say it's bitchy. So that's why they use that term. So the women doing the rating were roughly the same age as the participants, 20 to 25, and they were looking for signs like eye rolling, looking the Confederate up or down, laughing sarcastically. In one case, our participant said the sexy Confederate was dressed to have sex with the professor. So immediately they're assuming that this woman is just trying to have sex with the professor. These are women making this conclusion. That's important to note. One didn't even wait for the sexy woman to leave the room before exclaiming, what the F was that? Okay. And they said, of course, on their scale, that was a 10 out of 10 for bitchiness. But then they had a scale and, you know, they both observed, they both made marks, they added up the results, yada, yada, yada. And they said the result of all this, of their study, was that the sexy confident was not going to be making sorority friends anytime soon. The women were far more likely to be bitchy to the sexy Confederate, with a large effect size of 2, and their bitchy reactions were more pronounced than participants were with friends than with strangers. So, you know, if a woman is dressing in such a way that they would consider that to be trying to attract the opposite sex, there would be a certain reaction that women would have to this woman, even if they weren't friends. But if they were friends, it was amplified. Now then, they said the clinical term for this is indirect aggression. They said essentially it's aggression we don't want to get caught for. To quote the researcher, you tend to do it such that you won't be detected, she explained. Or you make an excuse for your behavior like, oh, I was only joking. Direct aggression is just what it is, verbal or physical aggression. Oh, my t-shirts came in. I've been needing to. Oh, more. Everything came in today. I've been needing to. I've been ordering a few things for a little. I'm playing this thing called Star Wars Card Trader. And so I've been ordering a few things here and there. And couple of the things, just a second, let me check this out. A couple of things I ordered were some t-shirts, and I just think these t-shirts are funny. They're a series that's based around a T-Rex. It's just a little goofy little cartoon drawing of a T-Rex about things that T-Rex hates. Because, you know, he's got short, stumpy little arms, so it's like T-Rex hates Flossy. Because he can't reach his teeth. T-Rex hates selfies. Because when he holds the phone, he can't get his arms out far enough. So all he sees is the underside of his chin. So, yeah, I just find that hysterical. So, anyways. So, this indirect aggression. There you go. Backing into my garage one moment. She says that the evidence favors the view that women have worked to stifle each other's sexuality. One moment. Let me get back in here without trying to run into something. There we are. The evidence favors the view that women have worked to stifle each other's sexuality because sex is a limited resource that women use to negotiate with men, and scarcity gives women an advantage. Which is absolutely true. This is why I was saying, you know, several weeks ago, that when they had this free the nipple rally, you know, and everybody's indignant, free the nipple, what, you know, and how that some of these women that are going to take their shirts off, they're like, because we live in a patriarchal society that holds us down as women. And I'm like, well, what? Hold on. All the guys I talked to about the free the nipple rally, they're like, that's fine. She wants to take her shirt off. I got no problem with that. Whereas all the women I talk to, they're like, I can't believe I'm doing that. And the women, and you know, it's my opinion that probably the women, the men who have a problem with it, really they have a problem with it because they know if they don't have a problem with it, they're going to get in trouble with their wives. So it's like, yeah, that's terrible. Oh, of course it's terrible. It's terrible. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. So anyways, I thought that was really interesting. Anyways. And you can see signs of this everywhere. They want to say later on that women were nearly three times more likely in another study, for example, to introduce the conservatively dressed woman to their boyfriend than the thin, sexy woman. Oh, okay. That's fine. To Valencourt, this showed that women are threatened by, disapprove of, and punish women who appear and or act promiscuous. And that's regardless of their weight, because they tried this as well, where they showed pictures to women where they took the same assistant dressed up in the short skirt and the boots, and they showed a picture of her like that, and then they used image processing software to make her heavier, you know, and they showed these pictures and asked women questions about it. Anyways, in research in the 1990s, psychologist David Buss found that women were more likely than men to denigrate or insult their mating rivals in two ways, as he described to me in an email. First, the slut factor. That is spreading gossip that the rival woman is easy, has slept with many partners, and is basically, in my terms, pursuing a short-term mating strategy. And second, on physical appearance, saying that a woman is ugly, has fat thighs, and an astonishing variety of other vicious things about a rival's physical appearance and mode of dress, such as wearing revealing clothing and plunging necklines and short skirts. In his book, this is David Buss, The Evolution of Desire, Strategies for Human Mating, he argues that women do this evolutionarily because evolutionarily, women who are willing to have casual sex undermine the goals of women who want long-term relationships. Quote unquote, slutty men hint to men that it's okay not to commit because there will always be someone available to give away the milk for free, as it were. Which is a really interesting dynamic. So, and really where you see this coming a lot more into play is in younger women. Valancourt says about these studies, "I wouldn't be bothered by someone dressing like that," Valancourt said, referring to the more alluringly clad woman. "But if I was 20, I might be bothered by it." So, you know, so what is the explanation then? That's kind of like the whole point of this article. What is the explanation? So Agustin Fuentes, chair of the Department of Anthropology at Notre Dame, told me, "Why are these women doing this? I think there are many ways we could explain that. In our society, if you're given the choice between these images, you're going to say, I don't want my guy sitting next to a girl with a short skirt. But that's not because evolutionary speaking, your guy is more likely to cheat on you with the short skirt girl. He argues that though this and other studies show how important physical appearance is to the way women respond to each other, there's too much cultural baggage at play to say that it comes all from our primate ancestors. The short skirt boots combo, for example, is already a meaning-laden image." So I don't know what he was actually getting to. It says, in her own research, Anne Campbell, a psychologist at Durham University in the UK, argued that young women tend to use indirect aggression to a greater extent than young men, in part because that's the most socially acceptable way for women to compete. And I thought that was it. That was pretty interesting. They're saying that by age 7, boys and girls are equally aggressive, but after childhood, it becomes less acceptable for girls to give each other noogies and the like, so women become far more indirectly aggressive, while men continue to be plain old directly aggressive. And she said, by the time we reach working age, the levels of indirect aggression between the sexes even out. So what's interesting is that when men bitch about their rivals, they tend to insult their lack of money or status, those things that they know women are looking for. So when they're trying to compete, men tend to attack other men on what those things are that they think women value. And that's why women go after after things like physical appearance and sexual promiscuousness, because they think that's what men value, which that's an interesting idea. So anything, can we do anything about it? Okay. Despite his skepticism about it reflecting on evolution, Fuente said the study was interesting because it showed that indirect aggression is very real and can be simulated with just an image. He says these social constructs are real for us, but we can change it. Okay. So the question then is, so how are you going to change it? Okay. Cattiness is damaging to the self-esteem of its victims, but Valancourt argues that becoming more aware of it, we can try to suppress it. Quote, studies show that if you change cognition, you change behavior, she said. The behavior causes harm. People become depressed if they are attacked in this way. However, Buss is not as optimistic, saying that it's not easy to change something that might, whether through evolution or conditionary, have become reflexes. He said that curbing the bitchiness in one area in which men can is one area which men can be a help rather than simply the object of competition. The only way it might change is if men stop Okay, see if this sounds like it's going to happen. The only way that it might change is if men stop valuing sexual fidelity and physical attractiveness in long-term mates. I don't think men are going to stop valuing. I mean, yeah, okay. That's unlikely to happen, though, he says, since these evolved mate preferences in men are as hardwired as evolved food preferences for stuff rich in fat and sugar. And the woman concludes the article by saying human nature can be such a bitch. Okay, to which I would respond, well, it depends on what your definition of human nature is. If your definition of human nature is the flesh, then yes, absolutely. Human nature can be a bitch. Because that's the flesh's job. It is the flesh's job to denigrate and to insult and to tear down. And so if you don't recognize that there is this force, and if you don't recognize how that force within you pushes you into these destructive behaviors in very gender-specific ways, in general, on average, because obviously everybody ultimately is different and we're all on spectrums. But in general, men are far more along on the lust side of the flesh attacks, and women are far more along on the fear side of flesh attacks. But when you look at this kind of behavior, okay, what ultimately does it matter how long the skirt is of a woman or how short? Why should other women react to that? Because they're afraid. That's what it comes down to. And so, yes, there is a way to mitigate this. There is a way to change this. And that is for women to recognize that that is being driven by fear, driven by lust. And when those feelings come up, you can use exactly the same techniques that men can use when looking at a woman with a short skirt. When their feelings of lust comes up, the best way to combat that is just to start praying for the woman, recognizing she is a human being, recognizing she has challenges in life, recognizing she may be deluded and thinking that somehow this is going to make her life better when it won't. And you can begin saying a little prayer. My God, I thank you that you have placed such beauty in the world. I just pray today that you'll bless this woman. If she's a wife, I just pray that she will find a place in her husband's heart that is a place of safety for her. I pray that she will be to her husband a wonderful confidant. I just pray that for her children, if she is a mother, that she will be a wonderful mother to her children, that her children will cherish her in her heart. And I guarantee you that if you start doing that, that will fix it. Doesn't matter whether you're lusting after her as a guy or you're afraid of what she's going to steal from you as a woman. If you will start blessing her, if you will start conceptualizing of her in her life and understanding that there's a reason she's dressing like that, she's seeking something. I have a policy, I've said this before at this point in my life, not to cold open any conversation with any woman between the age of about 16 and 30, because there's just no way to cold open a conversation like on the street or just in the store, anything like that, without that woman thinking that you're getting ready to hit on them. There's just no way to do it. Now, if they happen to be an employee in the store, usually what I do is I just start with, "Hi, how are you today?" as I walk by. That's all. "Hi, how are you today?" as I walk by. And I will do that for months. You know, now, if there's guy workers, you know, then I'll try to strike up a little bigger conversation. But for female workers, I'll just do that for months. And then if I start getting some response back, like, "Hi, how are you? It's good to see you again," all that kind of stuff. You know, then I might follow on with, "Hey, you know, how's your week been?" That kind of thing. And there's a worker in the produce at the Walmart store that we go to where we started this out. And then I came one Friday and they had rearranged the whole produce department, you know, just set everything up, changed everything around. And I saw her and I said, "Hey, a bunch of changes." And she said, "Oh," she said, "I can't believe this," you know. And so she comes over and tells me about all this stuff that's going on. And I listen and go, "Yeah, I understand that. Boy, this must be rough." You know, we have this really nice conversation. But I never cold open with a young woman who's between 16 and 30. Just never do. But getting back to, why are you dressing that way? What's your motivation? I had breakfast with a friend. Well, I was supposed to. He slept in. So I was leaving the restaurant and I was driving down the street. And mind you, I mean, it was at that point, it had to be in the 40s. It was a little chilly, 45-ish maybe. It was a little chilly. And I see this young lady walking down the street, walking someplace. And she's got this kind of light, filmy skirt on that is just hitting her at the knee. And she's wearing her little boots with her high heels on there. And, you know, walking and trying to look sophisticated, but she's walking on hard concrete, bare legs. And I just felt like rolling, slowing down and rolling down the window and say, look, get some funky pattern tights to wear because it'd be darling with that outfit, but don't freeze yourself to death. Well, of course, I'm not going to say that. But, I mean, she looked darling, but you just look at her and say, what is wrong with you? Put some clothes on. You know, at least get yourself some tights on so you're not freezing. But she, you know, feels like if she dresses up like that, people will like her more and valuable more, and maybe she'll be safer. And it's all just a fear response. And it's just sad when you see it. So, you know, when a woman sees another woman who is quote unquote dressing provocatively, and if they understand that woman is doing that because she is being driven by fear, and if they understand that woman and remind themselves that that woman is a human being who is struggling, who is trying to make her life safer and quiet the tumult within her, I will guarantee you that whatever bitchiness might start up in her heart at that sight, it will be quenched if she will just stop and reevaluate the viewpoint she has towards that woman. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.